How the book came about. Why don't you tell me a little bit about how you decided to do Real Peace?
Well, the book occurred to me as a result of a number of briefings I had done around the country, off-the-record briefings for various events that I attended. Some of them were fundraising events, some of them were non-political events. I visited cities like Atlanta, I was in Florida, I was in Philadelphia. There was one here in New York, one in Indiana, one in Kansas City. The briefings were on foreign policy. And I would usually talk for 45 minutes to 50 minutes and then take questions for a half hour thereafter. What concerned me about the briefings was that after making points that I thought were quite obvious about American foreign policy, what it had been, what it is, and what it could be in the future, and particularly about Soviet-American relations and Chinese-American relations, was that the people afterwards would come up and say, this seems very new. But to me it was not new. To me it was quite obvious, the points that I was making. And consequently, it occurred to me that it might be useful to get out a longer statement. I first considered the possibility of doing two or three op-ed pieces for the New York Times or for the Wall Street Journal before even submitting such pieces. I found that it was getting to greater length than they could cover in the 10,000 words or so that you could have in a couple of op-ed pieces. I moved from that to the thought of a pamphlet. As everybody will recall, back in the early days of the Republic, pamphleteering was the most effective way of getting anything across. Tom Paine, Common Sense, was basically a pamphlet to begin with, then became a book. As the pamphlet developed and the length became longer, I then decided that it might be better to make it a small book. And so the result was this book. I wrote the first draft, or I should say the outline of the first draft, interestingly enough, on July the 3rd, and finished it on the morning of the 4th of July.
I'm sorry, you wrote the draft overnight?
This was a 15-page outline.
And the outline.
I always approach such projects in an organized way. I think to get across points, it's very essential not to just throw out this idea and that one. It's very important to have it organized in a 1-2-3 order. And if you read the book, of course, you'll find that that's the approach. When I completed the outline, I then brought in a couple of my people from my staff, two young men, both of them very capable, who had worked with me on my book, Leaders. I showed them the outline, and I said, what I want to do is to get out a small book, no more than 100 pages, on Soviet-American relations. And I wanted to complete it in a very short space of time, because I wanted it to be timely. We went to work on it, and within about 7 weeks, as it turned out, we had the first draft completed. Then it went through 12 other drafts. But in the matter of less than 10 weeks, the entire manuscript was completed. Now, rather than publishing it, though, in the usual way, I found that in checking with my publishers, the Warner people, that they could not get something out that fast. I wanted it to be timely. Generally speaking, when you're writing a book, as I had learned in doing six crises over 20 years ago, and then later my memoirs, which was, of course, a 3.5-year project, and then The Real War, which took a year to write, and Leaders, which took another year to write, from the time you complete the manuscript to when the book becomes available for sale, 6 months lead time.
A minimum.
At least a minimum. But they usually want a year, but for me they had done it in 6 months on other occasions. That wouldn't do. So I decided to publish it privately, to publish 1,000 volumes privately. We had it printed privately, a few more, which I wanted available to give to friends and relatives and so forth and so on.
So Real Peace came out in a private edition of 1,000 copies.
1,000 copies, plus what I call the author's private edition, beyond that 1,000. The 1,000 copies went to leaders in the United States and abroad, distributed to about 60 heads of state and government and so forth, countries I had visited or leaders that I had met, to congressmen, senators, administration people, State Department people, and to the media people in this country. And, of course, a few people in the business community and educational areas who had indicated an interest in the subject.
These copies were mailed.
These copies were mailed. And once these copies were mailed, what happened was that the way the book finally was published by Little Brown is that Sam Summerlin of the New York Times syndicate, the New York Times syndicate, having distributed first Real War and then the Leader's book, the New York Times syndicate said that they felt that it would be that I should get a larger audience and ask for the permission to try to sell it abroad and in this country. I gave that permission, and Summerlin talked to Little Brown, among others. Little Brown said they did have the capability of getting it out fast. And so the result was that Little Brown then published, I think, in record time. What happened was basically that they took the manuscript, which was in the private edition. There was no editing whatever. It was brought up to date, bringing in, for example, the Korean Airline incident, which was not in the private edition, and a couple of other things that had occurred. And consequently, the book came out in record time and was timely.
Did they use the same plates?
Exactly, the same plates. I'm amazed at I'm not very good at all this technocracy things, but I'm amazed at how they were able to take the same tapes. They, Myron Strumke, who worked on it here in my office, brought me in the book, as he called it, and it was you could just hold it in the palm of two hands. The whole book on plates that was given to them. They used the same plates, and then of course. They published it in a very handsome volume.
Well, I noticed that the plates, the printing looked the same, so I figured it was the same plates. But I also noticed that the Little Brown edition did not end. It ended a page later than the page in the private edition. So I figured something had to be added. But I didn't have the patience to go over it word by word to figure what had been added.
The major thing that had been added was the references to the Korean Airline incident. The KL-07, which incidentally did not change my major thesis. There were many who thought that as a result of that incident, that was good reason not to go forward, for example, on arms control, on attempting to develop a new relationship with the Soviet Union. In my view, that was a strong argument to go forward. Very important that an incident like that in the future, if it should come, would not escalate into a conflict that would be destructive to both.
You got the private edition out in December, I believe. Is that correct? And the trade edition in January.
Actually, what happened was the private edition was out in November. The trade edition the commercial edition, which is now in the bookstores, was in. It came out December 15th, publication date, which, of course, as you know, means nothing. Except that that's when it's supposed to be available for reviews and so forth, was January 15th. But it's been in the bookstores, at least a few bookstores, starting about the 15th of December.
How large an edition did Little Brown print?
They printed, I think their first printing was 55 to 60,000. And I learned from them that they had already sold 45,000 and are going into a second printing. So it seems to be doing rather well commercially. I, however, did not write the book for commercial purposes. I was glad to have it reach a larger audience, but I wanted the book to be timely, and I particularly wanted to hit a very special, influential audience, decision makers in government and out of government who affect decision, and that is why, of course, it was distributed to a considerable number of media people who are interested in foreign policy.
I want to ask you a couple of things about the book in a moment, Mr. President, but did you finance the private edition yourself?
Oh, yes. Yes, I financed it out of my own pocket. That's right.
And
I think the private edition cost, my recollection is, in the neighborhood of about $20,000. And I was prepared to pay that. But as a result of its going public, that will, of course, be recovered.
Sure.
But I felt it was very important to get the message across. And it did get across rather effectively based on our mail and on the... you don't call them reviews, but I would say columns and so forth. Everybody from Richard Reeves, for example, to people like Kevin Phillips, people in the right, people in the center, even some considered to be a little bit more on the left.
Well, you can also tell by the sale. If you've sold 45,000 copies of the commercial edition, in a nation as large as ours, only 1% of the population will buy a hardcover book in a year. So, yes, it's amazing.
Well, I did not feel that this kind of book was commercially viable in any, like, a bestseller type, because it's a very serious book. It's not full of anecdotes. There's no gossip. There's no sex. Those are the things that sell books, as we know. This basically is just hard-nosed, hard-headed, pragmatic, some say cynical analysis of foreign policy, of the real world. And so I have been heartened, however, to an extent, by the fact that many who received it and many who have purchased it have read it through and seem to have understood it. Some don't agree with all of it. But this shows you the value, one, of making it short. It's only 100 pages. It can be read by even a slow reader in 3.5 hours. I know that because what I have done also is to record the entire book for the blind. I went down to Princeton and recorded it for the blind. They provide recordings of books for blind students across the country. I had learned about this through John McComb, the former head of the CIA, who is now legally blind, and he had told me about this organization. I got in touch with them. They were delighted to have me recorded. I think it's the first time an author has recorded his own book, and I read it in 3.5 hours. I did it. It took me 3 different days because you can't concentrate that well. But once you have written the book, it's very easy to record. I didn't have to do it over and over again because of being unfamiliar with the territory.
You actually went down to Princeton for the
recording? Yes. I would go down. I'd get up around 5 in the morning and get up early. Anyway, I'd arrive there at 7, and we would record for 1.5 hours each for 3 straight mornings. Okay. And that now has been distributed not only through them to students across the country. It's available in their library. It's a marvelous organization. They have over 50,000. Recordings of books, classics and so forth and so on, some novels and a few like this. But I sent it also to 160 Veterans Hospital across the country because I knew veterans particularly that would be interested in this subject. They furnished the recordings for me.
As you wrote the book, how did you do it? Was it through a process of dictation, or did you use those famous yellow pads that you use in the White House?
I do both. First, I start with a long outline, an outline incidentally which you'll be welcome to look at before you leave, just to see the process. That's all on yellow pages. That was done over, as I said, done in a very short space of time, sort of at white heat. Then from the outline comes rough first draft. And then comes the editing process. It goes through draft after draft after draft. Ideas come in the middle of the night. You jot them down, dictate them the next morning. And then in order to get it into the spoken word rather than the written word, because basically this book is a long speech, I would take the drafts as they came out, and then I would dictate them into a dictaphone, and the words would change so that it became more spoken rather than simply written. I don't know that that makes much difference to the average reader.
It does.
But if you read this...
It does. If you read an average newspaper story, the phrasing is convoluted.
That's right.
Tenses are awkward. Attribution often comes at the end. People don't talk like that.
That's right.
So people, I think, like to read the way they like to talk.
It's interesting to me that people that I greatly respect who are really authors, authorship for me is very, very difficult. I've never had a baby myself, but I think writing a book is like having a baby. It is an excruciating experience. It's very difficult. It doesn't just come off the top of my head as it does for some of the great writers. But to hear from somebody like Harrison Salisbury, the New York Times, who is a fine author, what impressed him about the book was its ideas, not all of which he agreed with, but most of which he did, the general approach to the Soviet Union. As you know, he was the Moscow correspondent for the New York Times for several years, was there in 1959 when I had my famous kitchen debate with Khrushchev. But what impressed him, I think, was the style, the fact that it was terse, as he said, muscular prose. I don't know what he means by that, but I was highly complimented because I don't consider myself to be an outstanding author. As I say, writing is hard for me, and I think the main contribution I made to this was to get it in the spoken word, to make it very simple, to have in mind, as I wrote it, that I wanted people who were not familiar, not sophisticated with these great issues, to be able to understand issues like arms control, issues like the Third World. What do we do about Eastern Europe? What about Chinese-American relations and so forth? So what we have here then is a book which, whether you agree or not with the conclusions, is one where people will understand what, at least my point of view. Another thing, incidentally, that I've done in this book, which you may not have noted if you read it, but I think if you read it carefully, you'll find it. If you go through this entire book, you'll never sign, you'll never find a place where it says, in my opinion. I had a lot of that in, and we often put that in when we write, sometimes even when we speak. But when I say something, that means it is my opinion. Why put in the words, in my opinion? You'll never find an of course. To say of course, say, as everyone knows, of course, etc., etc., that's talking down to people. Just stated as a matter of fact. So all of the of courses are out. In my opinions are out. There are very few I believes in it. It's obvious when you state something, you believe it. So I would say that in terms of this book, it is not only brief, but it is lean. And I think because it is brief and it's lean and it's simple, that it may get a message across more effectively than one of these huge tomes. Now, incidentally, one good friend, Armand Hammer, as a matter of fact, who has been to Russia and to China a great deal, he wrote back and he said, I hope you would, when you get out another edition, that you would write it at greater length and that you would have footnotes and bibliography and so forth. Now, there's no way I could do that. After all, to try to impress people by the fact that you have bibliography and source notes and footnotes and so forth, that's like writing for a doctorate's degree and so forth and so on. It's pure posturing, in my opinion. I've done it in other books, but I'm not going to do it again.
Mr. President, in a moment I'd like to ask you about your own library, but I think it's a good opportunity for you perhaps to summarize a couple of points that you have made in your book for me. For example, I took a line out of a book which I'd like for you to explain, if you could. While war has become obsolete as an instrument of policy, the tools of war must continue to play a role in keeping the peace. Well, what did you mean by that?
When you look at all of the books that have been written about war, and the classic, of course, was the book written by Clausewitz, On War. Incidentally, I read that again. I had read it many years before writing this. Generally speaking, as you look at those books, you will find that before the nuclear age, national leaders felt, as Clausewitz stated in his book, that war could be an instrument to affect national policy, affected or effected, whichever way you want to put it. In other words, the most famous quotation from Clausewitz is that war is a continuation of policy by other means. Now, that was true certainly up and through World War I. I think as far as the nuclear age is concerned, however, that is no longer a viable position. Using war as an instrument to serve national policy is not viable, particularly where nuclear weapons come into play. Because, as I point out in this book, and as everybody I think will agree, if nuclear war comes, you run the risk of doing as much damage to yourself as to your opponents and to the rest of the world. So what I am saying here first is that in the nuclear age, no sane national leader is going to make a decision, I'm going to declare war in order to gain this territory or this advantage. And if I declare the war and wage the war, I will come out ahead rather than worse off. That can no longer be said. On the other hand, we have to recognize that the instruments of war, particularly when you have in the world an offensive power like the Soviet Union, a power the Soviet leaders make no bones about the fact that they are going to continue to work to extend communist domination, not only in their area, but in other parts of the world as well. When you're confronted with that, you have to have a deterrent which will discourage that. And the only way that you can discourage an offensive power of that type is to have the instruments of war that they would respect. Let me put it another way. If the Soviet Union did not have the nuclear capability that they have, it would not be necessary for the United States to develop the nuclear capability that it has. No one seriously believes, the Soviet leaders say they think this, but I don't think they really believe it, that the United States is going to launch a war of aggression any place in the world. When you look, for example, at the period since World War II, well, let's go back further. The United States did not get engaged in World War I because we wanted anything. We weren't trying to expand our domination over Europe or colonies or what have you. The same is true in World War II. And whatever people say about Korea or Vietnam, the goals of the United States in each of those wars was not expansion, was not to serve our national appetite for aggression. The goal was to defend against aggression. And in the real world, when you have on the world stage another power which will resort to or threatens to resort to war to extend its domination, it is absolutely essential that you have the capability to make it clear to that other power that if they start war, they will lose more than they will gain. That is why a major theme of this book is we must have enough military power to take the profit out of war.
Is that what you mean when you say that we must have a pragmatic peace? We can't have a pragmatic peace with the Soviets.
we have to realize that as far as the Soviet is concerned, that one positive note is that they are not madmen. They are people who are ruthless, they're aggressive, they're tough, they will do anything that they possibly can if they think it will work in order to extend their domination, subversion, terrorism, what have you. On the other hand, because they aren't pragmatists, before they launch any kind of military activity, they are going to weigh the costs as well as the benefits that they hope to gain. And consequently, if we raise the cost of aggression, they will be deterred from resorting to it. That is what deterrence is all about. Raise the cost of aggression to the point that any potential aggressor will think not just twice, but a number of times before he starts anything.
Mr. President, my time is just about up, but I had...
No, we have plenty of time. To
Let me ask you one other question about the book. Actually, I guess this is a... there are several aspects to this question, because you have outlined in the book a number of myths. The myths of peace, the disarmament myth. And what is the myth of peace?
The myth is not of peace, but the myth is of what do we call perfect peace. In the minds of many very well-intentioned people, what we should work for is a world in which we have ideal peace, in which leaders and nations and peoples will get along together, in which there will be no conflict, in which war is simply unthinkable. Now, that's a world that never was and never will be. And particularly that is the case when you have the enormous ideological gulf between what we call the Western world and the Soviet world. Conflict is going to continue between our world and their world. All that we can hope to do is to manage that conflict in a way that it does not explode into war. I mean nuclear war or even conventional war. Conventional war, of course, in my view, would be escalated to nuclear in the event that that even came, and particularly if it should come in Europe. So what we have to do then is to build, is to think in terms not of a perfect peace, which is not possible, because from now on, as in the past, so it will be in the future. Men and leaders of men are going to continue to be competitive. And some will continue to be aggressive, unless they are convinced that aggression will not pay. Now, a pragmatic peace is something different. A pragmatic peace is one that looks at the world as it is, recognizing that there are nations, the Soviet Union being the most obvious example. There are nations and leaders who do not accept the proposition that we and most of the free world accepts, that war cannot and should not be indulged in, who do not accept the proposition that aggression can no longer be accepted. Under these circumstances, when you have the world like that, it is important that we first develop the capability to discourage and deter the use of armed force to carry out their goal of world domination. And second, though, and this is where we have the other side of the coin, not only that we have the military strength to deter aggression, but that we give such nations a positive stake in peace. By a positive stake in peace, I mean through trade, through contact, etc., convince that other country that they will gain more from keeping the peace than they will if they break it. It's very important, in other words, that we not just think in terms as what I call the super hawks call it, that all we have to do is to be stronger militarily than the Soviet Union, and then we will have a peace. That is only part of it. We must have the strength, the military strength, to deter aggression. But to have real peace that will last, we must combine that with positive incentives. That is where trade, on a very pragmatic basis, with the Soviet is something that we should certainly support.
What is the myth of disarmament?
For a long time, particularly in this century, we've had numbers of groups who have felt that if nations will agree to disarm, or if we can have armament control, that we will not have war. But we have found that as far as such agreements are concerned, that they do not prevent war. For example, after World War I, with Japan, the United States and Britain, we agreed to a 5-5-3 naval balance. It did not prevent Japan from launching war when they thought their interests would be served by it. And the idea that with arms control, that if we just have an arms control agreement, a freeze, for example, of nuclear weapons, that then there will not be war, that unfortunately is a myth. Now, arms control should be sought for other reasons, because it can create stability and the like. But what we have to realize is that even if we got an arms control agreement that no one thinks is in the cards at this time, in which both sides agreed to reduce our nuclear arsenals in half, we would still have a devastating war in the event that the political differences we have were to be allowed to get out of hand. What I am saying here is that it is not the existence of arms that brings war. It is the failure to resolve political differences that lead to the use of arms. That is why arms control agreements, which I support, must always be linked to the political conduct. And only if they do that will they be useful. Let me give an example. SALT II, the agreement between the Soviet Union and the United States, failed. Couldn't get the votes in the United States Senate. Why? Not really because of the substance of the agreement, but because the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan. Once they invaded Afghanistan, the United States Senate, there was no way that they would approve an arms control agreement with the Soviet Union. So what I am suggesting here is that unless we attack the political problems at the same time that we attack the arms problem, arms control agreement, nuclear freeze, and so forth are no guarantee that we're going to avoid war.
President, just before we wrap things up, when you were a kid growing up in Whittier, California, what did you read? What did you like to read?
Well, it depends on what stage of my life. I think from the very earliest time I was fascinated by geography. It was one of my best subjects. I remember, for example, that we couldn't afford it ourselves, but one of my aunts, Mrs. Marshburn, subscribed to the National Geographic, and when I was in the fourth and fifth grade, I used to devour that. In addition to that, I always liked history. I liked biography. I liked to read about great men, great women. I remember, for example, when I graduated from high school, my grandmother, who was a devout Quaker and a pacifist, gave me a biography of Gandhi. And I knew a lot about Gandhi before I ever went to India about 40 or 50 years later. I was particularly interested, too, in the biographies of the great Americans, particularly the American presidents. I read extensively Washington, Jefferson, Lincoln, T.R., Wilson, La Follette. Biography has always fascinated me, and that has stayed with me the rest of my life. For example, today, I read primarily biography and history. Now, that doesn't mean I enjoy a good novel, don't enjoy a good novel, but I just don't have time for it. And I would say this, too. I know you hear the old cliche to the effect that truth is stranger than fiction. I find truth much more interesting than fiction. I will always take a good biography over a good novel.
When was the last time? Remember the last novel you read?
Let's see. Oh, yes. Because it was somewhat historical type of novel, I read The Spike. I read it because Arno de Borchgrave is an old friend, is a foreign policy expert, and he was getting across an interesting message. But beyond that, as far as novels are concerned, I don't pay much attention. I would like a mystery if I had time to read it, but there are so many good books, great biographies, for example, that are available, that I've got a backlog that I will never be able to reduce if I spend the rest of my time and the rest of my life reading one a week.
Tell me a little bit about your personal library. These books must have been sent to you from world leaders for many, many years.
Yes, I'm very fortunate in that respect. Robert Menzies sent me one of his books, or two or three of them that he's written. I found him a fascinating writer. I have an excellent collection of Churchill books. Churchill's Marlborough, the First World War, the Second World War, his biography of his father, Sir Randolph Churchill, Lord Randolph Churchill. I have an excellent collection of Lincoln books, various biographies. I think one of my favorites, while some of the present historians don't rate it that high in terms of accuracy, was Sandburg, because it had the feel of poetry to it. While I read biography and history, deep down I think every politician has to be somewhat of a poet.
How do you have your library set up? I assume you have a separate room or two for your books.
Well, we have, of course, the good fortune to have an office where we keep most of the books. The library is not a very large one, but it is set up in a pretty organized way, because when I was in law school, between my second and third years, in order to afford to go to school, I worked in the law school library, and I learned how to put in books, how to organize them in a very very deliberate and effective way. So, like all the books on Churchill, and incidentally, I have ten volumes of all of his speeches. They're all in one area. Then biographies of other leaders, like Brian Crozier's De Gaulle, the Lincoln books, and then the historical, the history books. And I must say, I have a few novels there, but they're mainly for others, not for myself.
You must have many of the political books inscribed to you.
Yes. I would say that virtually every book on politics that has been written has come to my attention one way or another. I haven't room for all of them. Most of those I keep in the office. But for my own reading, I keep there the biographies, the history, and so forth and so on. And I find it very, very interesting, and to me, rewarding, to reread books. I think one of the best things Churchill ever wrote was the volume on the First World War called The Eastern Front. Now, it was better than what he wrote about World War II and World War I, in the sense that he was not there. When Churchill is there, Churchill carries out his famous maxim. He says the way to make history is to write it, and he becomes too much a part of it. But when he writes about the Eastern Front, it's some of the most eloquent, vivid writing that I've ever read. It happens to be about war, but it's more interesting because it's about people. I would rate highly in that respect, too, in the biographical area, the classic on Disraeli. There's a new Disraeli book out. There's several new ones, and I'm enjoying it as well. But Lord Blake's Disraeli is a must for anybody who is interested in politics or political life of any kind. And I would say, too, that from an historical standpoint, one of the most interesting books is one that I'm rather surprised has not become a bestseller in the United States, is Modern Times by Paul Johnson. Now, it's very controversial because he's a very outspoken man. He likes to be Peck's bad boy. I met him when he's in London. He's got red hair, and I can see that that comes through. He sees red at times, in the best sense. But this is, I think, a must book for anybody who wants to understand the world as we know it. It begins with Einstein and his coming up with the famous theories, and from the breakthroughs scientifically at that time, it carries us through the period from World War I up to the present time. And the historical sweep is really breathtaking.
I love talking about books and hearing what other people read. You can tell so much about a person. I was on jury duty across the street some years ago, and everybody had books to read, and you could tell the type of person by the type of book that he brought in with him.
Let me say one other thing that I would, a bit of advice to young people. Often, you know, due to my rather senior status now, is I don't like to be called an elder statesman. I'll be called a senior statesman in the moment. But young people come in and say, what should I study if I want to enter politics? And I rather surprise them, and I think disappoint many people who teach political science, and say, don't bother with political science. No. No, I went to a small college. We didn't have any political science teachers. But we had great teachers of history, great teachers of English, great teachers of French. For example, I remember I had 4 years of college French, and there's, I could read and write it when I left college 50 years ago. I can only understand a bit of it today and perhaps read a bit. But there's nothing like reading Voltaire, Rousseau in French. My advice to any young person, particularly during his high school, college, and even graduate school period, when his mind is young, when he's got plenty of time, he can a lot of energy, is to read as broadly as he can. Develop the habit of reading, because that, while there is nothing specific that he will learn about politics, he's going to get a feeling about people and the forces that move people far better than he would by learning how do you operate a precinct and how do you analyze a poll. You can learn all that by participating in a campaign. You don't have to take a political science course and waste your time with that. So I would urge every young person who wants to enter politics, read everything you can get your hands on, particularly history, biography, philosophy, and if you really want to get bored, read economics.
Try to get kids to read in electronic age is
I think one of the curses of television is that people look at the tube so much and read so little. Sir Robert Menzies, the Prime Minister of Australia, who, in my view, if he had been born in England, would have been a great British Prime Minister, like Winston Churchill, one of the great leaders I've ever met. Robert Menzies told me something in the years I was out of office. He said, every individual should set aside a part of each day for reading for pleasure. By reading for pleasure, for him, it did not mean reading mysteries or novels, although I'm not against that. I mean, that helps too, because you can learn a lot reading poetry. You can learn a lot, perhaps, by reading a novel. But he, like anybody who spent his life in politics, he used to read biography and history and so forth. And he would always allocate some time for reading for pleasure. A half hour a day. He says if you can't do that, always have at least an hour or two on a weekend when you set aside all the papers, all the things that you were supposed to read, and you pick up a book, reread something that you've liked in the past or something new. And I think if our young people could think that way, rather than just planting themselves in front of the tube and listening to some talk show or the local news or God knows what, I think we'd be better off. Now, let me make it clear, I'm not anti-television, because I must say I'm a sports nut. I won't miss the Super Bowl, and so forth. But every time I find myself getting hooked on some whodunit or something like that on TV, I just look up at those books and say, if I spend another hour or two listening to TV, I'm not going to get through the books that I should get to.